This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Al Hirschfeld was a familiar figure on Broadway during much of the 20th century, known for his wonderfully expressive drawings and caricatures of actors and theater people. His long lines and strong brushstrokes captured the personality of his subjects at rehearsal and in performance. His work was published in the New York Times and in many publications. He had a colorful description of himself, a couple of huge eyes, and a huge mattress of hair, no forehead. The forehead that you see is just the hair disappearing. Al Hirschfeld died in 2003 at the age of 99. Our guest David Leopold got to know Al Hirschfeld over a 13-year period, visiting his studio on a weekly basis. David is a curator, writer, historian, also creative director of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation. He's also edited and written a brand new coffee table size book called The Hirschfeld Century, Portrait of an Artist and His Age. He also curated a companion exhibit at the New York Historical Society, and that runs through October 12th. And David Leopold joining us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Always a pleasure.
So how does one get to know Al Hirschfeld, or how did you get to know Al Hirschfeld?
Well, you know, he was in the phone book. And
really?
He was a totally normal guy who happened to be a genius. And I was doing some research on Ben Soloway, an artist from Bucks County, who did charcoal portraits from life of everybody on Broadway, opera, film, and dance for the New York Times and the Herald Tribune. And when I was looking at his clippings, Hirschfeld drawings would be either right next to it or on the back. And I decided, wow, Hirschfeld might know something about this man. And so I wrote to him. And he wrote me back the nicest letter I ever got from a stranger.
Really? What did he say?
He had told me that they were acquaintances, that he really enjoyed. I had sent him some examples of the work, that he remembered the people. It was a great sort of time capsule to go back in. And if I was ever in Fun City, I should come by and quaff some tea.
And, is that a quote?
Yes.
Fun City being New York,
you know,
I
New
guess.
York, of course. And so I did that. I contacted him, and next time I was in New York, and I went up there. And we hit it off, and I was so pleased with myself. I hit it off with Al Hirschfeld. And it turns out that everybody hit it off with Al Hirschfeld because he was just a decent, nice guy.
Well, in fact, you describe some of the parties, I guess dinner parties that he would have at his house or his apartment, I guess, in New York. And it sounded like not only would the Marx Brothers or other people be there, but it sounded like just such a convivial experience.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, lunch was the same thing.
Oh,
there'd
really?
Be people coming by, people calling, people stopping by all the time. He knew everybody, and everybody knew him. There wasn't anybody in the times that I knew him that hadn't grown up with his work as much as I had or most people who had seen his work. And he had this amazing ability to live completely in the present. So he didn't look at it and say, these are friends from the past or friends from the, you know, now. They were all friends. Mm-hmm. They were all people who enjoyed his company, and he enjoyed their company. He loved people.
Did you consider him? Did he consider you a friend?
Oh, yeah. We got to be got to know each other very well. I have, in fact, hold the record of the most free lunches at the home of Al Hirschfeld.
And how many are we talking here?
Oh, well, you know, once a week for 13 years, it adds up. And we would spend a lot of time, you know. He was allergic to talking about the past. He was not very interested in it. He was interested in the here and now and maybe what was opening next week. But the past and the future didn't mean anything to him. It was what was going on today. And that's what we talked about. We talked about what was going on in the theater, what was going on in the world, what was going on in the street, people that we knew, you know, mutual friends. And you know, it was just a good time. And then we had this interesting vocabulary about his work. I have a visual memory, and I can remember things that I've seen. And, you know, so we would be talking, and I might make a reference to an obscure drawing from 1932, and he knew exactly what I was talking about. Just like he would talk to me, he would say, oh, and this, and I know. Yes, I know exactly what he's saying there. And, of course, he used to slander me frequently in interviews. People would ask him about dates and something about the past, and he would say, oh, I have an archivist now, and he's put everything in order, and so I can't find anything.
Yes, archivists, or I guess artists often do that.
Yes.
complain about what the archive's trying to organize their life. He's had a number of self-portraits, certainly included in this book, some famous ones as well. And, I mean, he looks like an Al Hirschfeld drawing.
Oh, very much so. It was the way he saw the world. I mean, when he looked in the mirror, he saw Hirschfeld just like when he looked on the street or across his dinner table. They were Hirschfeld drawings. People asked him for years to teach, and he said his feeling was he couldn't really teach. It was the way he saw the world, and he would encourage other people to draw what they see.
Now, he grew up in St. Louis at the very beginning of the 20th century.
Yeah, born in 1903, he was born and raised in St. Louis. His mother and father had met there. His father had gone to Texas to be a cowboy and discovered that was a lot of work. And his mother had just come over from Russia. They met at a boarding house, and despite the fact that neither one of them spoke each other's language, they got married and had three boys. His mother ran a candy shop in front of the house. His father never really worked.
Really? He was not, just couldn't hold down a job?
Not interested.
Just not interested.
Strangely enough, when they came to New York, he would eventually get interested. As he got older, he got interested in the plight of older Americans and helped to coin the phrase senior citizen. In his 90s, he was speaking at Carnegie Hall about the plight of older Americans and coined the phrase senior citizen. I mean, it's just one of the crazy things that was a typical day in the world of Al Hirschfeld. But when he was in St. Louis, a local artist befriended him, mentored him, took him on sketching trips around the cities, and realized that this kid had talent, and came to his parents and said, "You have to take him out of St. Louis. If you keep him here, he's going to end up doing what I'm doing, which is window dressing and place cards for society dinners."
And they took him. I mean, they moved the family.
The
to
whole
New
family.
York.
They
for Al, in a sense, for their son.
Mostly for Al. His one brother also had a talent on piano, and they thought maybe this would be good for him. But when they got to New York, Al started taking classes at the National Academy of Design, where he said he learned the only things you can be taught, which are anatomy and perspective. And you know, he just took off from there. You know, his first job is when he's 17 years old,
and he's the art director for Selznick Pictures?
Oh, yeah.
That comes maybe a year later or
something.
Yeah,
about
like
a year
that.
And a half later. He starts off as a gopher at Goldwyn Pictures. And movie making in 1920 is like the internet of the 1990s. It is a totally wide open field, new media. Nobody had ever seen it before. I mean, the idea that you could see a performance, that everybody could see the same performance, millions of people could see that same performance at the same time or on different days was – I mean, it's hard for us to understand it today, but it was huge. If you had wanted to see Al Jolson before the films, you had to go to the Winter Garden and see him in that show that night. And all of a sudden, you could see him in Peoria or Los Angeles or Philadelphia, you know, all those places. And that was a huge leap in sort of not just the entertainment world, but in communications altogether. And Hirschfeld was on the ground floor of that. He had started working as a gopher, but he couldn't stop himself from drawing, and soon they started to publish his drawings. He left Goldwyn, went to Universal, and met up with an 18-year-old David Selznick. His father, Louis J. Selznick, was running Selznick Pictures, which was not the biggest studio, but it had the biggest advertising budget. They had the largest billboards in Times Square. And David Selznick thought that Al had a lot of talent, and he convinced his father to hire him as the art director of the studio. And Al took a brownstone at where the Museum of Modern Art is today, hired a stable of artists who were all older than he was, and they churned this stuff out.
Wow.
And this is all before he discovered caricature. I mean, he hadn't, at this time he's doing fairly conventional work.
Well, in fact, I was going to say it's so interesting because we know him now for his use of that line. You know, that's
sure.
a very energetic line, but you see his early stuff and it is kind of traditional. Some of it looks like pointillist. Some of looks like, what you might see at that time at the beginning of the 20th century.
Well, he was doing all this work to pay the room rent, as he said, because he really wanted to be an easel painter. He had started off wanting to be a sculptor, and he discovered a sculpture was just a drawing you could trip over in the dark. And he wanted to be a painter and had a good amount of success. Had shows in New York, Paris, Chicago, St. Louis. He was doing all right. But it was this – he had been introduced to caricature, which was sort of the vogue at that time in the mid-1920s. Selznick went bankrupt, and Hirschfeld was left holding the bag for a lot of bills. And he spent the next year and a half – this is 1924 – he spent the next year and a half working for Warner Brothers, never going into an office. That's the one thing you have to understand about Al is he never went into an office. He always worked in his studio and would drop off the drawings. And he did them on his own. own time. And so he was working for Warner Brothers, but he would bring the drawings down. And he, at that time, where his studio was, he had met a he was 20 years old. He at a party at Carl Van Vechten's, he meets a 19-year-old artist who's just come from Mexico by the name of Miguel Covarrubias. And the two of them take a studio together. And it's Covarrubias who really turns him on to caricature.
Well, it's interesting because caricature can be a little nasty. I mean, it can have a kind of hard edge. You're sort of playing with people's in this way, sort of distorting or even exaggerating people's features. But his work is not malicious.
No,
it's not benign, but it's a sort of loving, friendly picture of somebody.
I always think of it as what your friend would do rather than what your enemy would do. We can make fun of it. When you're friends with somebody, you can say really the worst things,
right,
you know,
right.
And it's not so bad. But Al wasn't even like that. He didn't have the bile needed to be a mean person. I mean, if he had any deficiency, it was that. And the caricature that he grew up in was not a caricature of a put-down. It was really a form of modern art. It was the overloaded portrait. You know, it was trying to capture the personality and the character. You know, he was probably the 20th century's greatest caricaturist, maybe the greatest caricaturist of all time. But the fact is, he really didn't practice caricature as we traditionally define it. It isn't a put-down. He uses exaggeration, but not anatomical distortion. There's no big heads and little bodies. He thought things like that were as funny as looking at yourself on the back of a spoon. You know,
oh, the kind of slightly distorted look you get from that.
But there's no wit to that. Right. It may make you smile, but there's no wit to it. And he was looking more for that sort of epigrammatic portrait, you know, that sort of like an Oscar Wilde epigram, you know, something that would make you think and would sort of outlast, you know, the lines that we know from Importance of Being Earnest live on despite the fact of whatever the play is. And that's what Al was trying to do. He was trying to create art that withstood its topical value, that would had more value to it. And it's only now that we're seeing how successful he was, because audiences today, younger audiences today, millennials, don't look at the work and say, oh, Katharine Hepburn, she was great in this, or Carol Channing, I love seeing her in this. They look at it like we look at Lautrec's work of Jane Avril. When he did those pieces in the late 19th century, I'm sure they were very accurate. I'm sure they captured the sense of what she was doing in the cabarets in Paris. But today, there's nobody alive who would have seen that. And so we look at it for aesthetically. It doesn't matter who it is or how accurate it is. It's a piece of art.
And that's David Leopold. We're talking about a book that he has edited and written. It's called The Hirschfeld Century, Portrait of an Artist and His Age. That artist, of course, Al Hirschfeld. And that's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. I see some tweets coming in at WHYY Radio Times. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can call us. Any questions or conversation or questions or comments, yes, for our guest, that's the word, David Leopold, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with David Leopold, creative director of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation. He's curated an exhibit of Al Hirschfeld's work at the New York Historical Society. It runs through October 12th. We have put some of Al Hirschfeld's work on our homepage, and you can check that out as well. And if that weren't enough, David Leopold has a new book. It's called The Hirschfeld Century, Portrait of an Artist and His Age. What's so interesting in watching the sort of evolution of this artist is how he was influenced by some time that he spent in Bali. And on the face of it, I thought, you know, what does Bali have to do with these line drawings that we so associated with Al Hirschfeld? How did that work for him?
Well, it's so unusual in the sense that by 1931, Al Hirschfeld found the Depression depressing. And he had read Mutiny on the Bounty and had decided to go to Tahiti to paint. And when he gets there, he is appalled at the culture that's there because it seems like it's imported from central casting in Hollywood. The natives are playing Irving Berlin songs on ukuleles. You know, everyone is trying to do the Paul Gauguin experience. And he writes, his friend Covarrubias has felt the same way, and he went to Bali. And so Hirschfeld writes to him as he's leaving Tahiti saying, this place is terrible. I've got to go someplace, someplace else. And Cove Rubius writes him back. It reaches him in Australia. And he says, I found paradise on earth. It's so beautiful here. I'm going to go back to New York to get he wanted to make a book deal. He actually got a Guggenheim Fellowship to write what is still a primary text on Bali. Wow. And he said to Al, if you can get here, I'll leave everything for you. And Al trades a painting to a ship captain and by way of Madagascar ends up in the village of Denpasar. And he said there that the sun was so bright that it bleached out all the color. And all he saw were black and white line drawings walking around. Huh. And he said that's where his love affair with line began. And he spent 10 months there. And while he painted, and we have a number of paintings in the book, it's the first time they've ever been published.
And they're beautiful. Yeah, I mean, they're lush and colorful and...
I mean, he made a very conscious choice in his life. Mm-hmm. He could have gone a very traditional path, but its line just starts taking over his interests. And he finds that the native culture of Bali totally encourages that. They don't have a word for artist in their language. They refer to him as the clever one. And he was fascinated by shadow puppets, you know, how expressive and how much character they could convey just in shadow and line. And when he comes back to New York, the bright spotlight of Broadway replaces the bright sunlight of Bali. And there's a drawing that we have in the book that only was recently discovered, actually. We had a clipping of it, but the drawing showed up in the most, you know, unusual way in a back room someplace of George Jessel and Fanny Bryce on stage at Brooklyn's Paramount Theater. And he has them arranged just like a shadow puppet. Show. And it's a direct connection to what he was doing.
Well, it's so interesting to look at his career, his long career. He said, I became aware of what I was doing when he was in his 30s. So it took him a while. And I think for any artist, those are wonderful words to hear, is that this stuff takes time to sort of find your tools and your vision.
Well, he believed that talent was a drug on the market, but that it was discipline that really made the great artists. And he worked all the time. He loved to draw. He couldn't stop himself really from drawing. So while in the 20s, while his friends were interested in what works went into museums and the smartest magazines, he was working for newspapers and movie studios, and his work was being seen by literally millions of people. By the time he was 25, he has an audience in the millions. And he only gets more popular for the next 75 years.
Was he rich? Was he a wealthy man?
He was.
Or does anyone know?
Yeah. Oh no, he was. Oh, he was wealthy by any standard, by New York standards, by just general American standards. He had signed. He had told me one time that he didn't realize he grew up poor until he started making money in 1927. When he's art director at Selznick Pictures, he's riding around town in a Stutz Bearcat, and you know, he's got a great life. And when they go bankrupt, of course, he loses all that. But in 1927, he agrees to a $15,000 guarantee contract with MGM, where they paid for each of the drawings about $35 or $50 a drawing, but they guaranteed him $15,000 worth of work in a year. He said they always went over. And that was just one studio that he worked with. He was working for several studios. And up until 1943, he was working for at least three New York newspapers, plus magazines, book covers. When album covers begin in 1938, Hirschfeld does early album covers and would continue to do album covers for the rest of his career. In fact, there's a great secondhand, used record store in New York, Secondhand Rose down in Union Square. They have a whole section just of Hirschfeld album covers because there's so many of them over the years.
I'm assuming he was a well-known figure on Broadway, you know, going to either openings or going to plays or even rehearsals. Would he work in the dark? I mean, how would he do his drawings from real life?
Well, the way he worked was he liked to work from life. That was his preferred. And he would go to out-of-town tryouts because for most of the 20th century, for at least the first three quarters of the 20th century, a show did not open cold in New York. It would start in Philadelphia or Boston or New Haven, sometimes all three of those. And the shows, they would, once they put them in front of an audience, they would know what worked and what didn't. We saw it recently with Hamilton in New York. Lin-Manuel Miranda decided that hearing the audience told him more about the play than anything else, and that's why he wanted to wait to open it on Broadway. So Hirschfeld would go to these. He learned to draw in his pocket because he knew that there wasn't a lot of light in the theater. He didn't want to distract audience members from what he was doing. And since he couldn't see it, he trained himself to do it. He thought it was like typing. You don't look at your fingers when you're typing. This was a very spontaneous, direct eye to hand to pad. And he would create sort of hieroglyphics he would capture. He was looking for some gesture, some movement, some piece of costume that might reveal the character of the performer, the character the performer was creating. He used to say that his job really was taking the character created by the playwright, portrayed by the actor, and he would reinvent it for the reader. So he would take these sketches and then come back to New York. And in his studio, he would sometimes augment this with some photographs. He claimed he had a faulty memory, which was completely not true. And, yes, I'm calling Al Hirschfeld a liar.
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah.
Friends can do that, by the way. And he would collate these into his drawings. Wow. And there wasn't a formula. And in fact, he told me at one point that when he felt that he was doing something that felt like he had done it before, he would stop and start a new drawing. Because one of the great things about his career is he was ubiquitous. And one of the toughest things about his career is that he was ubiquitous. He couldn't keep doing the same drawing. He never fell out of favor. He didn't have – the traditional arc of an artist's career is it take a long time to figure out who they are. They have their peak moment, and then there's the inevitable decline. Hirschfeld doesn't have that. He discovers who he is relatively early in his career and just gets better at it and has an audience that is completely with him the entire time.
You include a quote. He says, and this is a chapter titled, "The Line Gets Big. I'm still involved with the mystery of line and what it can do. I found no formula. It's difficult not to fall back on what you did before. All I know is to keep paring it down, eliminating until it's pure line that communicates." I mean, not only was he a wonderful drawer, he's also a wonderful writer, it seems, of what he is doing and of people. And himself.
He wrote several wonderful pieces. The best is probably this wonderful satirical book called Show Business is No Business. But he ended up giving up writing because he said in writing there were 150 ways you could put the line, and in drawing there was only one way. And that's really what he was doing. He wasn't a minimalist. He wasn't trying to just pare it down for the sake of paring it down. He was like a poet who was trying to convey everything that needed to be said with no extraneous words. And for him, it was no extraneous lines. And that quote comes in the 1980s. So he's in his late 70s, early 80s, and he never stops pursuing what it is that he's doing. He never stops experimenting. At this time, he starts doing these drawings for the Friday Theater column in the Times. It's a teeny little space. And for a man who had commanded six columns out of the eight columns of the top of the fold of the New York Times for decades, to have this very small space should have been a real barrier to him. But instead, he keeps on getting better at what he does and is able to say more with less.
The he that we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times is Al Hirschfeld, and our guest is David Leopold. And we're talking about David's new book. It's called The Hirschfeld Century, Portrait of an Artist and His Age. We have posted some of Al Hirschfeld's drawings on our homepage. Also, you can check out this exhibition at the New York Historical Society. It runs through October 12th. This is a curated companion exhibit to the book. And our guest is the creative director of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation. And to join the conversation, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. I do want to read some tweets here. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And we also have some Facebook comments as well. In fact, a tweet from Lisa, still miss his Nina hugging drawings. A Facebook comment from Kathy, we should have a Nina contest. And for the uninitiated, David, you should tell us who and what was Nina.
Well, it starts Nina, in Philadelphia. Yes. Al is in Philadelphia for an out-of-town tryout of a pretty forgettable musical called Are You With It that took place in a circus. He comes back to New York, and his wife is in the delivery room. She's about ready to have a baby. If it would have been a boy, they would have named it Mark, because Dolly Haas, his wife's favorite American author, was Mark Twain. But Al's lucky number was 9. And they had decided if it was a girl, they would name her Nina. And so Al gets back to New York. His wife is in the delivery room. Doctor comes out. Congratulations, Mr. Hirschfeld. You have a baby daughter. Once he determines that his wife's okay and that his daughter has 10 fingers and 10 toes, what does he do? He goes back to the studio and finishes the drawing. And because the show took place in a circus, there were circus posters in the background, you know, half man, half woman, world's strongest man. And he has a poster of a little baby reading a book, and it says Nina the Wonder Child. It was a joke for family and friends. He had been sticking in portraits of his friends in his drawings for years. Nobody had paid any attention except the people they were intended for. And that's all this was. And, of course, he was a proud father, like, you know, most fathers. He was very proud. And he did this for a couple of weeks. And he stopped because he thought the joke had sort of run its course. And he got all this all these letters, all this mail saying, spent all Sunday looking for Nina. Where is it? And he realized, well, I'll keep doing it a little bit longer. People like it. And after another couple of weeks, he stops. And the mail is even more. And although he would try to stop it a number of times over the years, right, he learned, as he said, the hard way to make sure he put her name in the drawings before he put his name in the drawing, because nobody was looking for his name.
And they was were that all something he did, his... he sustained through pretty much his career?
Oh, yes. It became completely organic for him. In fact, he was like everybody else. When he finished a drawing, he had to count the Ninas because, I remember one day I'm in the studio and I'm working on – you know, cataloging something, and he's drawing, which was typical of what we did. And he calls me over and he says, how many Ninas do you see in this drawing? And I thought it was a gag. And I look at him and he says, I can only find four, and I'm pretty sure there's five. And if I get the number wrong, the mail will be incredible. And I thought that was hyperbole. And after he died, I go into his file cabinet. He had a three-drawer file cabinet right behind his – he worked in a barber chair. He thought it was the most functional chair in America because it went up and down, swiveled, could turn into a Shea lounge. So I go into this file cabinet, and there are all these letters from people, you know, complaining about getting the number wrong. You know, someone writes in, well, I'm now going to add Al Hirschfeld to the things we can no longer count on. And, you know, and he kept the funniest ones, and they amused him. And they're now all at the New York Public Library for the performing arts. Yeah.
I also read, and perhaps it was probably in your book here, that fighter pilot training used some of these Ninas, also training doctors to read X-rays, using the embedded Ninas to help train their eye.
The Pentagon used Hirschfeld drawings to train bombardiers in the 60s to help them look for their targets, you know, that they may not be entirely obvious. And there is, I don't know if he's still working, Dr. Calvin Nodine at the University of Pennsylvania would often write the New York Times because Al would cite the $60,000 grant that Dr. Nodine got to study Ninas and Hirschfeld drawings. Well, he wasn't really studying Ninas and Hirschfeld drawings. He was using Hirschfeld drawings to help train doctors to look for things in X-rays that they might not normally see, like breast cancer tumors. And he actually did a considerable amount of work, and he found that the Hirschfeld drawings were sort of the best thing to use because on the face of it, you don't see them. And then the more you look, the more you see. Al was amused by that. I mean, to him, when he called something insane, it was a seal of approval, and he thought that was insane.
There's a wonderful little comment here. He had several wives. The first wife, a chorus girl, a woman named Flo Allen. He said he married her because everyone told me not to.
Yes.
Is that the sort of – is that a window into Al Hirschfeld's both humor and personality?
Exactly. You know, you couldn't tell Al what to do, and Al wasn't interested in telling anybody else what to do. You know, what I think is also very significant about Al is he never abuses his position. He never does things and you say, oh, I can't believe Al Hirschfeld did that. Right. He's devoted to his art, and he realizes that his audience is devoted to his art. And so he gives it all to his art, and he doesn't spend time doing other things. I mean, in 1946, S.J. Perlman, who was a great friend of his, probably among his best friends, convinces him that they should write a musical comedy together. And they write it, it's called Sweet By and By. It takes place in the future, 2076. They unearth the 1939 World's Fair time capsule, and it has candy shares in it for a tree surgeon in Bryant Park. I mean, it's completely ridiculous.
Yes.
The music was by Vernon Duke. The lyrics by Ogden Nash. It should have been a big hit. It was a tremendous flop. It closed right here in Philadelphia in October 1946. A week before it closes, though, Al and Sid Perlman have lunch with the editor of Holiday Magazine, because at that time, Philadelphia had Curtis Publishing, and they did so many great magazines came out of Philadelphia.
Right.
And I don't know how many martinis they drank that day, but by the end of that lunch, the editor, Ted Patrick, had commissioned Perlman and Hirschfeld to travel around the world writing articles. They and the two of them were delighted, because the thought of going back to New York with a flop was something they really couldn't handle. So they sneak back into New York. They make their arrangements. They get a book contract from Simon & Schuster. They leave for 9 months, the longest time Al's not on Broadway. They come back with a bestseller called Westward Ha, or Around the World in 80 Clichés.
Oh, goodness gracious. Well, there is a drawing in here, Death in Philadelphia. And one of the things that Al Hirschfeld says is, we, in the, describing, you know, this collaboration, we met for lunch at the old Lafayette Hotel Cafe that same day. I don't remember what I ate at that luncheon, but 15 years have passed since then, and the gas pains are still with
yes.
me.
Oh, Al could be devastating and funny, you know, and about himself, a self-deprecating man, of course. And his friends, you know, a lot of his close friends were writers, and he had a real affinity. He was a very well-read guy. And in fact, as he got older, his biggest complaint was that nobody wanted to stay up as long as he did anymore. Young people, old people. And so he ended up reading more. Because this was a man who worked every day.
Seven days a week.
Loved it. I mean, just loved it. Got up in the morning. His studio was on the top floor of his brownstone. And I think the reason he got to be 99 and a half is not only was he doing what he loved, but it was a four-story brownstone. He was constantly walking up and down the steps, you know, for lunch and whatnot. And then he would go out every night or have people in.
That's David Leopold, and we're talking about Al Hirschfeld. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with curator, writer, historian David Leopold. And he's got a brand new book. It's a coffee table size book called The Hirschfeld Century, Portrait of an Artist and His Age, talking about Al Hirschfeld, his drawings. Really immediately recognizable, these long, lean, energetic lines. His work was much in demand throughout most of the 20th century, drawing actors and celebrities in Broadway and Hollywood. And we're talking about the life and the art of Al Hirschfeld. And again, our guest is creative director of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. Also, check out some of the pictures that we have put on our homepage. Also, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. In fact, a tweet from Matt said, did he prefer musicals, comedies, or drama? Do you know?
He had no favorites. When he went to the theater, he was an open book, ready to see what was happening. He loved, there were many musicals he loved. He loved, you know, and he was great friends with Rodgers and Hammerstein and Cole Porter. Harold Arlen was a great friend of his, Harold Rome. He's in the rehearsal room when Harold Rome first sees Barbara Streisand for the first time and gives her first Broadway break. He was great friends with Eugene O'Neill and captured probably 50 productions of O'Neill's work over his lifetime. He didn't have any particular favorites. He was interested in people. Mm. And if they were a person, he liked them.
And did he care if they liked what he drew of them? Did it matter to him?
It didn't. He used to say that, you know, when he started, he got complaints, and then later they turned into accolades. And he felt that he was doing the same thing the whole time. So he understood that it was how people viewed it. What he was trying to create was a drawing that stood on its own two feet. And the recognition part of it, he understood, was important to get paid. And it's what editors wanted. It's what audience wanted. He was a visual journalist in that regard. But he thought that was the easy part.
Yeah.
It was creating the drawing that would survive any news value that it might have was what he was really interested in.
And Alan Funt, apparently he was the head of Candid Camera,
oh,
said
yeah.
he made me look like a monkey.
Yes, he complained.
Did he reconcile that over time?
Well, Al had drawn Funt, and Funt claimed he looked like a gorilla. And when Newsweek called Al to ask his response, he said, "That's not my doing. That's God's work." So, I mean, he understood that maybe not everybody was going to like it. And in fact, it was another Pennsylvania thing. We almost lost Al Hirschfeld at the New York Times because of the Bucks County Playhouse. In 1939, July 1st, 1939, Al was there at the opening of the Bucks County Playhouse, a very starry night in the Playhouse history. And he did a drawing that appeared the next week on the front page of the drama section of the New York Times. It had all these different people out front of the theater. And in the center of it was Bea Kaufman, Beatrice Kaufman, George Kaufman's wife. And she hated the drawing, demanded that he be fired. She was a very significant figure in her own right. And she had just that kind of juice to make that happen. Fortunately, cooler heads prevailed. It looked just like her. And he kept his job. Mm-hmm. But and then a few years later, they would go exclusive with him in the sense for New York newspapers. Because at that time, he was in – the Times goes exclusive with him after an editor comes to him and says, "I opened the papers on Sundays." And this – there were still probably 10 – Sunday newspapers in New York at that time. And he says, "I opened the paper on Sunday and I can't tell which one I'm reading because they all have your drawings. What can we do to get you exclusive to the New York Times just for newspapers?" You know, he worked 75 years for the Times and on average appeared every other week for 75 years. Mm-hmm. And that represents less than half of his work. There are so few publications that he didn't draw in that it's almost insignificant. As I said, movie studios. He did more covers for TV Guide than any other artist ever. Many of the great posters that we know from films were drawn by Hirschfeld. When The Wizard of Oz first came out, Al did 5 out of the 6 posters that were used to promote it. All the Laurel and Hardy posters for their first 8 films, all the great Marx Brothers posters. We have a great one in the show of Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland and Strike Up the Band. They're gorgeous. They're just absolutely gorgeous. And he helped define those people, those performers for an audience. I mean, we see Laurel and Hardy much more like Al Hirschfeld saw them than anybody else saw them, because he created that great image. The sort of he said that they always look like the number 10 to him, you know, Stan Laurel being the 1 and Oliver Hardy being the 0.
You were a friend, as I was, of Tony Auth. Also, you.
Sure.
A curator of his work.
Yeah.
Curated the exhibition that was at the Michener. Tony was an artist in residence here at WHYY. Pulitzer Prize winning editorial cartoonist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, among his many accolades. And I have to say, looking through this book, I feel Tony's presence and energy and humor.
Definitely.
And passion.
Yes. Well, great newspaper artists, you know, who were part of a daily conversation or a weekly conversation are, I think, a breed unto themselves. That fraternity has always been very, very small. And Tony and Al both represented different parts of it, but they liked each other's work. One of our touchstones when I first met Tony was Al's work. And he was as interested as anybody else. And in fact, I had started writing this book before Tony passed away. He read the first chapter. I had done it, and I said, "What do you think? Is this what you're looking for in an Al Hirschfeld book?" And it's just a shame. Oh, he loved it, and he couldn't wait to see the whole thing, and he was just so thrilled for me and excited that Knopf was doing this. And it's bittersweet in that regard, because the love that Philadelphia has for Tony Auth is similar to what New York has for Al Hirschfeld. And again, nationally, they're both national artists who worked in a very, in a regional setting, but had a national effect. And I think they're equals in many ways, although Tony would never see it that way because he had such a great deal of respect for Al's work. But I know that Al would have seen Tony as a fellow traveler, as it were.
Very nicely said. Let me get to, it looks like Susan from Northeast Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Susan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
A great show again.
Thank you.
I'm an artist, and I do realistic portraits. And I know that if I get it a little bit off, it doesn't look like the person anymore. And yet I think the genius of Al Hirschfeld is that he did a lot off, and it looked exactly like the book.
Yeah, yeah. It's very well said, Susan, and you're smiling.
Well, I mean, because he wasn't looking for photography. He wasn't trying to recreate reality. He was really interpreting it all the time. You know, I tell a story late in the book. One of the last pieces he did was a drawing of the five conductors of the Philadelphia Orchestra. And when that drawing was done, it came out and I thought, oh, this is fantastic. And we sent it down to the Philadelphia Orchestra. And about a week later, I get a phone call. Could you come down? And I come down and it's the head of the Philadelphia Orchestra surrounded by all of his deputies. And we get in there, we sit down at a table, and all the deputies start complaining about this. Moody doesn't look like this, and Savalovich doesn't look like that, and he got Stokowski wrong, and you know, and they gave me all the complaints they had. And I said, okay, I said, Beethoven's Fifth is a piece of music that everybody knows, and the notes are written down. We know exactly what it is. So if I gave that score to each one of these conductors, of course it would sound the same. Well, of course, these orchestra people got completely offended, and they said, well, no, it's interpretation. And I said, and that's what you hired Al Hirschfeld to do. If you had wanted a photograph of them, you should have gotten a photographer, but you hired Hirschfeld to interpret them. And Joe Kluger, who was the head of the orchestra at that time, turns to me and says, turns to his deputies and said, have you shown this to anybody outside the organization? They were contemplating doing an edition of 100 impressions, etchings. And he said, can we have the weekend to talk about it? And of course, sure, you can do about 3 months. I don't care. Now, this was pretty late in the game. It was October 2002. Nobody knew that Al Hirschfeld would be gone within 3 months. And on Monday, this was a Thursday, on Monday they call. They said, yes, we want to go ahead with doing the edition. We have one question, though. Could we do an edition of 200 rather than 100 because it's so popular? And it became a huge success for them, and then a big fundraiser for them. But it just goes to show you that I think by not being constrained by trying to recreate reality, he got to tell more about the people and show more.
Well, Susan, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, but her question is an interesting one, but it just shows what a great artist he was. I mean, the fact that he could use just a couple of lines or take a feature, and as she said, you knew exactly who it was, even if it didn't really look like them.
And that is the alchemy of art that we can't really put our finger on. I mean, what he did, we can see a part of a Hirschfeld drawing and know right away it's a Hirschfeld drawing. It's not – he didn't use any special pens. He didn't have a special technique, maybe working in a barber chair. But I don't think if you work in a barber chair, it's going to do anything different. It was very much who he was. It was his DNA that you're seeing there. It's funny, about 20 years ago, I was in Hirschfeld's studio and Knopf had come to him. A contingent from Knopf came to him and they wanted him to do an autobiography. And Al said, oh, that's a whole other career. And I turned to them and I said, well, he's written an autobiography. We know everything that he saw and what he thought was important. It's all there. And of course, they were looking for a piece of literature.
Of course.
And as fate would have it, they got it 20 years after they thought they were.
Fair enough. He did, like a number of artists in the 20th century, have a kind of flirtation with communist Russia or even communism itself.
Oh, sure.
Went to the Soviet Union.
Well, when he married that showgirl in 1928, they go to and spend 5 months in Moscow. He's made an international correspondent for the Herald Tribune. He interviews all the heads of the Russian theater and film scene, which is then at its zenith. It's the greatest moment of a Russian theater and film. He sends back articles, illustrated articles to the Herald Tribune about this. He writes an entire book. He does interviews with Stanislavski, Eisenstein, all the movers and shakers of that movement. When he brings the book back to New York, he gives it to his publisher, Bonnet and Liberite, a very well-established publisher, who proceeds to lose the entire book, drawings and manuscript. And Al had never even made a copy of the manuscript. And if I ever saw regret...
You mean lost it?
Lost it completely. Never showed up. The only time I think I ever saw regret cross Al Hirschfeld's face was in talking about that book. Wow. And he just also ascribed it to, well, that's the way things go. You know, he wasn't one to cry over spilt milk.
But he seemed to, in the end, prefer Groucho Marx to Karl Marx.
Yes. When he went there, he thought communism was going to be the salvation of the world. I asked him at one point, did he ever join the party? And he said, well, he wasn't really a joiner, and that he thought that the Communist Party was a Lonely Hearts Club for pimply-faced kids, is how he described it to me. And so he never, he never joined the party, and he would come to realize that capitalism couldn't be all bad because even he could make money doing what he loved. He had a lot of friends who were blacklisted. He never shied away from support from them. And yet he was also great friends with Ilya Kazan, who named names. So he could be friends with people on both sides of the divide, and they all felt that he was with him.
Let me see what Dan from looks like Allentown has to say. Dan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, David. I had a question about Al Hirschfeld's drawing style and his art. Whether or not he followed a formula. I see a lot of artists nowadays, they will start with sort of a skeleton of the thing that they want to draw and then build out from there, say a person, they'll start with like the stick figure and
right.
sort of develop that. Did he have any sort of style like that, or did he sort of start with a line and then just go? It seemed like he was sort of just a
He really didn't have a formula. He really had no formula. And I would see him work in the studio. And at first he was just he didn't make a lot of preliminary drawings. He would take his sketches and then come back to the studio. And he'd worked on a fairly large board, about 20 by 30 inches. And he would use pencil and he would start sort of mapping out the drawing. It didn't always start. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it would be a head. Sometimes it would be a figure. Sometimes it would be some piece of background. And when he got the drawing to a point where he thought it was ready to ink, it wasn't really finished, but he thought it was ready to ink, he would start to ink it and put in all the details that he wanted to do. And then when he was done with it, he would erase all the pencil lines. So all the preliminary drawing would just disappear. And he would say that when he was rushed, he would do a complicated drawing. And when he had time, he would do a simple drawing because eliminating is harder than you think. You know, taking things out and still making it look right, feel right, and have its own sort of music to itself is hard. And he didn't really know how it all worked. And he decided that after years of trying to figure it out, that maybe it was best not to know.
Not to because even try to figure it out.
It was working well for him.
Well, we're almost out of time here. He dies at the age of 99, and it sounds like worked up almost till that last
till the day before
moment.
He died. He wow. was in the studio. And in fact, I called him the day before he died. We talk fairly frequently on the phone. And when I called and his wife said, oh, Al's in bed. He doesn't feel well. It was a real shock to me because he had never, in all the years I'd known him, he had never missed the bell. He'd always been at the studio. He'd always been working. And the next day, she called and said that he died. Oh. On his deathbed, he was drifting in and out of consciousness. I talk about it in the book. And all of a sudden, his arm goes up in the air and he starts drawing in the air. And his wife says, Louise Kurz Hirschfeld, his third wife, a wonderful woman, and until very recently, the president of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation, says, Al, what are you doing? And he says, I'm practicing my perspective. You know, so all the way to the end, he's still just totally committed to drawing and what it could do.
David Leopold, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Congratulations on the book, The Hirschfeld Century, Portrait of an Artist and His Age. David has curated a companion exhibit. It's in New York at the New York Historical Society, and he is the creative director of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and we have put some of Al Hirschfeld's drawings on our homepage. Claire Moran, the intern this summer for Radio Times, Kevin Griffin, our engineer, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.